From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds. Who was Jesus? What was he about? That's been a question debated by countless scholars for centuries. Iranian-born religious scholar and writer Reza Aslan weighs in with Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth. Reza Aslan has degrees in religious studies. His previous books include No God But God and How to Win a Cosmic War, God, Globalization, and the End of the War on Terror. Reza Aslan was also a fellow at the renowned Iowa Writers' Workshop. Thank you so much for stopping by.
Thanks for having me. It's a great pleasure to be on the show.
Before we get to the substance of the book, I've got to ask you about the much-commented interview over the weekend, the Fox News interview with Lauren Green, in which she asked, you're a Muslim, so why did you write a book about the founder of Christianity? BuzzFeed Post said, is this the most embarrassing interview Fox News has ever done? The New Yorker's Emily Nussbaum called it demented. You looked a bit shocked.
Well, honestly, I was a little bit embarrassed. I mean, look, as a scholar, the last thing that you want to do is have to constantly defend your scholarly credentials. You come off kind of as a putz doing that. And it was embarrassing because I felt as though I was in this weird position where I had to constantly defend my right to write an academic book, you know, about Jesus. But, you know, at the same time, I get it. I understand. I mean, you know, Jesus is a touchy subject, and I understand that there are people of faith who feel worried, threatened, that perhaps I'm somehow attacking them, but nothing could be further from the truth.
You know, it's a little unusual to hear an interview like that in a network broadcast interview, but I'm wondering, when you're meeting people off the air, do you get questions like that?
I don't. And this is remarkable. I mean, you know, I've written a lot about religions mostly about Judaism and Islam. And this is the first book that I've written about, you know, the person who launched Christianity. And the most remarkable thing about it is how overwhelmingly positive the response has been from Christians, mainstream, you know, mainline Christian groups. I think that anybody who reads it, there are certain aspects of the Jesus story whose historicity is discounted in the book, but that should not, I don't think, affect anyone's faith.
Historicity. I'm going to use that 10 times. I understand that Zealot rose to the top spot on Amazon following the interview. Do you think the interview contributed?
Well, I'm sure it did. Though, you know, I'm proud to say that I was already, I think, at like number 3 or 4 on Amazon. But I will say this. I want to thank Fox News for helping me defeat J.K. Rowling. I got her. I got her.
Reza Aslan is weighing in with Zealot to the Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth. You've probably heard about it. We're at 206-543-5869. That's 206-543-KUOW if you've got a question for him. So let's turn to the substance. You write that Jesus in his time was a politically conscious revolutionary. And I think it's helpful to kind of sketch the times that Jesus was born into and what was going on in the region where he was born into and growing up.
Yeah, you're talking about one of the most tumultuous eras in the Holy Land, which is frankly saying a lot, because that's an era that has seen a lot of tumult in the last 2,000 years. A time of apocalyptic expectation. The Jews were living under direct Roman occupation.
A very brutal
military occupation. By, you know, an empire that was anathema to everything that Judaism stood for. The Hebrew scriptures, the Old Testament, call on the Jews to cleanse the Holy Land of all foreign presence, to dedicate it as a place solely for those who worship the God of the Bible. And many, many Jews in Jesus' time took that command quite seriously. We refer to these groups as zealots. There were all kinds of different kinds of zealots. You know, there was a zealot party that arose much, much later. But zealotism was a sentiment that was widespread in Jesus' time. It was founded upon this uncompromising devotion to the sole sovereignty of God, a desire to free the Jews from the yoke of Roman occupation and to cleanse the land in the name of the one God.
So it was very political to have a stand like that as well as a religious stand.
Well, I think it's important to understand that in Jesus' time, there was no difference between religion and politics. They were one in the same. I mean, just Jesus' statement I am the Messiah would have been seen as a deeply political statement. The Messiah means anointed one. The job of the Messiah is to recreate the kingdom of David, to usher in the rule of God. Well, if you're ushering the rule of God, then you are ushering out the rule of Caesar. So the world of religion and politics were one and the same in Jesus' time.
And as Monty Python hinted in The Life of Brian, there were lots of messiahs back then. They were all over the place. He wasn't the only one.
One of the most satisfying things about this book is the response it has gotten from Python fans. Aha! I told you Life of Brian was right. Yes, it is a historical fact that there were a number of messiahs during Jesus's time. Many of them are mentioned in the New Testament, actually. Some of them were far more popular, far more successful than Jesus was, had more followers than Jesus did. But it is, of course, incredibly significant to note that of all those messiahs, 2,000 years later, only one of them is still called Messiah.
And you also point out that crucifixion was not a method of execution used for everyone, and that important historical fact tells us a lot about Jesus of Nazareth.
Yeah. I mean, you can really start Jesus' story at the end with him on a cross. Crucifixion was a punishment that Rome reserved exclusively for crimes against the state. In fact, it wasn't really a capital punishment. It was often the case that Rome would kill you first and then crucify you. The purpose of crucifixion was to act as a deterrent against rebellion, against sedition. That's why they were always done in, you know, marketplaces, on hills, in crossroads, in at the opening of the gates to cities. Essentially, this was a message to subject peoples of what happens if you defy the will of Rome. So I often argue that if you know nothing else about Jesus except that he was crucified, that's probably enough to begin to question the popular image of him as this kind of pacifistic preacher of good works.
And the inscription on the cross called him the King of the Jews, which was itself a very dangerous political statement.
Yes, of course, many Christians think that this was some sort of sarcastic bit of humor on the part of the Romans, who were known for many, many things, but humor was not one of them. That's called a titulus, and every single criminal who was crucified by Rome received a titulus outlining the crime for which they were being killed, because again, as a deterrent, it was important for everyone to be able to see why these people were writhing on a cross. In the case of Jesus, the crime is quite clearly striving for kingly ambitions.
And the Bible story talks about the two thieves that were also crucified on either side of him. But you say that's kind of a misunderstanding of how they were actually labeled.
Right. The Greek word for thieves is lestai. And lestai doesn't actually mean thief or thieves. It means bandits. And bandit was the most common term in Jesus's time for an insurrectionist, for a revolutionary. In fact, Jesus himself is called a bandit at one point in the Gospels.
I'm talking with Reza Aslan about Zealot, the Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth, where he looks at Jesus not as a religious leader as much as a political leader and places him in the context of his times. There was a major event that happened after the death of Jesus and before the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John were written. That was the Jewish revolt. And you sort of say that the way that those Gospels were written was heavily influenced by this event, which took place after Jesus died.
Yeah, so about 30-something years after Jesus' death in 66, these zealots, a group of zealous Jews, managed to actually kick Rome out of the Holy Land. It was this kind of miraculous moment in Jewish history. And they kept Rome at bay for about 3 to 4 years. When Rome returns in 70 AD, they slaughter everybody. They destroy Jerusalem, burn it to the ground. They raise the temple of God, defile its ashes. What few Jews are left alive are exiled from the Holy Land. Ultimately, Jerusalem is renamed Aula Capitolina. The great Jewish historian Josephus says it was almost as though no city such as Jerusalem ever existed by the time the Romans were done with it. And Judaism itself became kind of an outlaw religion. The Jewish cult was no longer viewed as a legitimate cult under Rome as a punishment for this rebellion that occurred in 66. Why that is important, why that history is important, is that every single word ever written about Jesus in the Gospels was written after that event. And as important as it is to put Jesus himself in the context of his day and age, the first third of first century Palestine, it's also important to put the Gospels in the context of the day and age in which they were written. These were written at a time in which the kind of revolutionary zealotry that really marks Jesus as a movement leader was needed to be stifled as a result of what happened in 66 and 70.
I'm talking with Reza Aslan. You can talk to him too, 206-543-5869. He's made a study of many religions, most recently of the life and times of Jesus of Nazareth. The book is called Zealot. It's 800-289-5869. You can write to us, conversation at kuow.org. You debunk the biblical trial of Jesus before Pontius Pilate. You say that's highly unlikely that that ever happened. Why do you say that?
Well, look, the job of a historian, especially one who deals with ancient sacred history, is to examine the claims of the Gospels according to the history of the time that we know. And the story of the Gospels of Jesus standing before Pontius Pilate and Pilate going through great pains, really suffering to do everything in his power to free Jesus, but ultimately being forced, quite literally forced by the Jews to put him to death, reluctantly washing his hands of the entire event, really does not jibe with what we know about Pontius Pilate. This was a brutal, hard Roman who on a regular basis sent his troops out onto the streets of Jerusalem to slaughter the Jews when they disagreed with even the slightest of his decisions. He was so brutal, in fact, that Rome ultimately recalled him. So, in other words, this guy was even too brutal for Rome, if you can believe that. It really becomes difficult to imagine the historical Pilate spending even a second's time pondering the fate of yet another Jewish rabble-rouser, one of thousands that he has sent to the cross, let alone being strong-armed by the Jews into crucifying him.
And yet, what if Jesus of Nazareth was such a popular hero at the time that Pontius Pilate wanted to make an example of him? So he wouldn't do this for your average, everyday revolutionary person, but he would for Jesus. You don't think that's credible either?
No, actually, I say that. Yeah, I say that, you know, if there is a kernel of historicity, if you will, I'll use that word one more time because you love it
so
much. Yeah. In that story, it's that, you know, Jesus was such a threat to the political stability of Judea that he received an audience with the governor, as opposed to, I'm sure, the thousands of other rabble-rousers who went straight to the cross. And that may very well be true, but again, it just then solidifies the larger point of what a troublemaker this guy must have been to be standing in front of the Roman governor.
The Jesus of the Bible that I remember from Sunday school, where the doves around the head and peace and love and acceptance. But the one part of the Bible where Jesus comes across as a revolutionary and kind of a badass is when he goes to the temple in Jerusalem and he's in a rage and he overturns the money changer's table and he releases the sheep and cattle that are being sold for sacrifice. That's kind of not like the Jesus we see elsewhere in the Bible.
That's my favorite story, and it's one that is actually in all four Gospels. Many scholars believe that it's probably traced to the historical Jesus, and it unquestionably was the event that precipitated his arrest, torture, and execution as a state criminal, because we have to understand that the temple was not just a religious icon. The high priest was a figure of both religious and political renown, and indeed, the temple was not just the center of the Jewish cult. It was in many ways the presence of the Roman occupation. I mean, Pontius Pilate and his legion of Roman troops actually lived in the Antonia fortress that was attached, literally attached to the temple. So any attack on the business of the temple would have been seen as equivalent to an attack on Rome.
Let's go to Jeanette, who's listening to us today in Kirkland. If you just tuned in, yes, we're talking about the life and times of Jesus of Nazareth. Reza Aslan has written about it in Zealot. That's the title of the book. Jeanette, thanks for giving us a call today. What's your question?
Well, I wonder what actual proof is there that Jesus of Nazareth, the one that's written about in the Bible, how do we actually know that he lived?
How do we know that Jesus isn't just a legendary figure?
Yeah, thank you, Jeanette. That's a very, very good question. And frankly, some scholars believe that he was legendary because truly outside of the New Testament, we have almost no trace of the historical Jesus, which, by the way, makes sense. We're talking about an illiterate peasant from the backwoods of Galilee. It's very rare that during his life anyone would have bothered to write about him. It's only after these claims are made about him that people's attentions start to turn to him. But I would say that the earliest and most reliable non-biblical source that we have mentioning Jesus of Nazareth is a throwaway line in the same historian that I mentioned before, Flavius Josephus, who in 94 CE in a book called The Antiquities is writing about people that Josephus thinks are far more important, actual historical figures, Festus and Albinus, the governors in Jerusalem, Ananus, the high priest. These are people who matter. And as he's telling this story about what happens when one governor dies and we're waiting for the next governor to show up and how the high priest takes advantage of the vacuum of power to start putting his enemies to death, he mentions sort of in an offhanded way that one of the people that the high priest puts to death is this man named James. And then he says, the brother of Jesus, the one they call Messiah. And he moves on. Now, it's important to understand that Josephus couldn't care less about Jesus. In fact, the phrase, the one he calls Messiah, is quite clearly supposed to be dismissive, like, you know, that guy. But what's and in any case, he's not even talking about Jesus. He's talking about James, his brother. What I think is incredibly significant about that is that it proves that by 94 CE, so some 60 years after Jesus died, his name and his movement were so well established that Josephus assumes his readers will know which James he's talking about if he just references James's much more famous brother, Jesus.
Does that answer your question, Jeanette?
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your phone call. And Jesus had a brother. Or maybe
he had four brothers. Yeah, he had four brothers as they are named in the Gospels. Yes. James, of course, was the most important of his brothers because he really becomes the leader of the movement after Jesus' death. He's the successor. In fact, in the ancient chronicles, he's often referred to as the Bishop of Bishops. Very important figure who ultimately is killed by the high priest in the year 62.
You know, the book almost is – it's like a negative because you take a look at the history and from there kind of infer what Jesus, the person, may have been like. So does any of the historical research say anything at all about the resurrection? Jesus rises from the dead, the boulder rolls back, and he ascends to heaven. Is there anything – any historical record of that?
Well, the problem for the historian in talking about the resurrection is that it's by definition an ahistorical event. It's an event that is a matter of faith, not a matter of history. So I don't talk about the resurrection itself, but what a historian can talk about is the claim of the resurrection, what I refer to as the resurrection experience. What is a matter of history is that very soon after Jesus' death, his followers claim to have had this ecstatic experience of the risen Jesus. And you can dismiss that experience if you want to, or you can take it on faith. But what cannot be denied is that these men and women said that they saw the risen Jesus, that they went to their deaths continuing to claim that they saw the risen Jesus, and that, frankly, it was that experience that transformed this, you know, movement by this itinerant Jewish wonder worker into the largest religion in the world.
There's a lot of literalism about the Bible. And from reading your book, it seems as though you're saying that we shouldn't really consider it to be literal history at all. That's not even what it was written for.
You know, what we call history as an accumulation of empirically verifiable facts and figures is a product wholly of the modern age. That definition of history is just a few hundred years old. In the ancient mind, history was not about an accumulation or an uncovering of facts. It was about revealing truths. And so I think the best lesson that we could learn about how to read not just the Gospels, but really any ancient sacred text is to understand it the way that the people who wrote it understood it, which is it was never meant to be understood in a literal fashion. The purpose of the stories in the Gospels, whether they're historical or not, and whether you see them as historical or not, the ultimate purpose of them was to make an argument of faith. These were testimonies by people who already believed that Jesus was God, and then set out to prove that by writing the Gospels.
Kevin writes to ask, was Jesus light-skinned as he is on the cover of your book? Sell it.
Yes, well, of course, Jesus was blonde and blue-eyed. I thought we had already agreed on that.
And muscular.
Yes, well, that Jesus is a little bit lighter-skinned than I would, like. I think Jesus looked a lot like me. No, I don't mean to aggrandize myself, but, he was a Middle Eastern. He was a Semite. He probably had very dark skin and a sharp nose like I do, and he looked like, a modern-day Israeli or Palestinian.
Aha, so you're confessing that the cover photo on your book may not be entirely real.
You wonderful people out there who are still under the mistaken impression that authors get to choose their covers. Oh, if only. No, I really love this cover. I think it's a compelling photo, and I'm very happy about it.
Lots more that we didn't get to, but you could read about it in Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth. Reza Aslan is the author of it. Thank you so much for coming by. I've enjoyed our conversation.
Thank you, and I'll be at the Seattle Public Library tonight at 7 p.m. Come on by.
David Hyde produces the show with Arwin Nix. Bernard Ouellette is our engineer from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. I'm Ross Reynolds.